This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild. Welcome to Progressive Radio. Today it's a real honor to have on the show one of the best political illustrators in the country, Steve Brodner, who has a new book out called Freedom Fries, The Political Art of Steve Brodner. Steve Brodner, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you, Matthew.
How'd you get started as an illustrator? Were you one of these kids who was always drawing, gifted as a prodigy?
Yeah, I was that, you know, a kid growing up in Brooklyn without a lot to do. Not a very athletic or popular kid. That's the story of a lot of cartoonists. You know, just somebody likes to sit around and draw and finds that that's the thing that people really praise him for. You know, like, wow, you know, you could draw Bugs Bunny. Hey, everybody, look at this. He could draw Mickey Mouse. So you, of course, you wind up doing more of it because now this is making you popular. You realize it's something you can do. You're not just blending into the scenery anymore.
And was this a natural gift, if there is such a thing, or were your parents artistic?
I think the gift was always the joy. I think that's true of art, and that's why somebody becomes an artist or becomes anything. Is that the minute they do something, something resonates inside, something in their core starts to vibrate, and they say, "Whoa, this is a great experience. I'm going to do more of this." And of course, the more you do, generally speaking, the better you get, and the better you get, the greater the hit. So then you it just feeds on itself, and pretty soon you're doing it for a really long time. And anything that you put tons of time into, you get better at. And then also, we're talking now about the early to mid 60s, a time of great social and political upheaval, a time also of a great deal of satire in the culture. You know, I remember a TV program called That Was the Week That Was. Those are old enough to remember that one from 40 years ago. Mort Saul, Lenny Bruce, and then Vietnam came. There was the Laugh-In and the Smothers Brothers, and it was, you know, David Fry, Fire Sign. It was just one thing after another that you were bombarded by.
And these are examples not just of creativity and express yourself, but of people who intersected with the political world as well.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Dick Gregory was a big activist and a humorist. And so it was not out of the blue. It wasn't unusual that people who were creative were also trying to influence public life. And I've taken that with me. It's paradoxical or interesting that so many years later we're sort of back there. It's sort of come around again.
For a while there, though, there was a sense not just of illustrators but of artists, and I'm thinking of writers and even more particularly of poets, I guess,
yeah,
that the idea was not to be political, that the being political was scorned upon, that it wasn't true art if
right.
You let the political interject itself.
Yeah.
But you never were troubled by that, really.
Well, you know, in art school I was getting that message all the time also, you know, that content, period, is to be scorned. That if you're telling a story with a piece of art, that's immediately a mark against it. Formalistic concerns were all there was. When you did a painting, it was about spatial consideration and color concerns and textures and the fact that the painting might be a response to something that one human being feels toward what's happening to another is well, that was beyond corny.
So how'd you rebel against that?
I nearly got thrown out Cooper Union as an art student in the early 70s. It was just not done, and clearly it was my great love to combine all these things. The arts that I love are arts where ideas and pictures and patterns and rhythms all come together. I you know, Stephen Sondheim, Gilbert and Sullivan, Jonathan Swift, Cervantes, these are things I love. Ben Shahn, You know, so to me, these people are accomplishing something extraordinary and delicious. They're doing many different things at once, and to me, that's challenging and exciting. I always wanted to be sort of like that, part of that. But the school tried to throw me out, and the dean went around to the different teachers and tried to get them to change the grade so it would be a lower grade. And then,
but I hear in the introduction you survived because you entered a contest that you won.
Unexpectedly.
Some very famous illustrators.
That's right. And it was an organization called the Population Institute, and they had a national cartooning contest. And I entered a cartoon. And as it turns out, the cartoon won first prize. And because they had a good PR agent at this organization, it got flashed across the world. New York Times had an article that said, Student 19 Flunking in Art Bests Top Cartoonists.
Which implies that it was a fluke, though, in a way. Or that you were a genius, one or the other.
I think neither were true. I think it was just that that cartoon happened to catch the fancy of some people who wanted to give it the award, and then found out later that it was a 19-year-old kid with a funny story to tell, and then the publicity department went to town on it. But Al Hirschfeld was a judge, and Charles Adams, I think, won second prize, and Gary Trudeau won third prize. And here was this amazing night in a restaurant in New York with the awards ceremony, and all these famous people. I mean, can you imagine, 19 years old from Brooklyn, this is not my world, you know. And through the crowd, I could see weaving his way the president of Cooper Union, in a tuxedo and drunk as a skunk, and he came up to me and said, "My boy," you know, and he grabbed me around and hugged me as if I were his most prized achievement. And it turns out that it was a lucky thing, because the school then was very happy to give me 6 credits the next semester just to draw political cartoons for the Soho Weekly News, which was a paper in New York at the time.
So then you were off and running. I'm speaking with Steve Brodner, author of Freedom Fries, a collection of his political art over the last 25 years, which really, if you just picked it up and looked at the pictures, you'd get an incredible sense of the characters who were ruling or dominating our world and the events of that world over the last 25 years. It really hit home to me because it starts with Reagan, which is where I started in journalism. I came to Washington in June of 1980, and then 6 months later, in come the limousines and the furs and the Ronald Reagan Revolution. And so you pick up on that and you just take it. Tell me about Reagan and what you enjoyed about drawing Reagan.
Well, Reagan was the greatest challenge of any caricature that I've ever done, because Reagan, I don't think too many people know this, and I don't have hard proof, but I can tell you for sure he had a severe facelift. If you look at photo, anybody wants to go back and do research and look at the Reagan running against Gerald Ford in 76 and compare those pictures to Reagan running against Carter in 80, you'll see a completely different face. Evidently, Nancy found his way to a fine Beverly Hills plastic surgeon and transformed the face that we all knew, those of us who remember Death Valley days, and you know, Reagan as governor, in which he was the aging movie star. He was this craggy, kind of, you know, prune-faced, bitter old man, you know, crunching heads at the university in the late 60s. And suddenly, after the facelift, the shape of the face changed. The eyes were no longer hooded, but sunny little eyes. But most significantly, aside from the elimination of wrinkles and wattles, was the lifting up of the cheek area, so that even at rest, the face appeared to be smiling. And this was dramatic and historic. It changed history, because now, instead of a cranky old, you know, washed up movie actor, Reagan was suddenly everybody's jolly grandpa. And the jolly grandpa was just the image everybody who were behind him needed to sell basically cranky, ugly policies that were cutting people off.
I mean, so the question then comes up as someone who does illustration, satire, caricature. If someone has these superficial features that have been changed to improve them, or, for instance, if someone's just good-looking, what do you do to spoof that person or to get to the heart of that person more profoundly?
Well, the challenge for the caricaturist is not to necessarily is to never be sandbagged by those realities, because what you're doing as a caricaturist is telling a story using the features of the face as elements in your illustration. So someone like Reagan, who is now kind of a jolly, happy, go-lucky, good-looking old man, could be transformed into a clueless front, which is what he was. So you use the smile. You use the rouged cheeks and the colored hair and the whole thing, the way he would wave when coming off the tarmac and pretend that he couldn't hear the reporters because of the engines of the helicopter. It was a common technique of his to avoid answering questions. That whole thing was the Reagan years were the most, until Bush recently, the most egregious example of media manipulation. These guys were masters, Deaver and Meese and the others.
Baker, too.
And Baker, right. They knew what they had, and they knew how to sell it, and he was a perfect actor in the movie. So that's what you would portray. You find your features. Someone like Nixon, for example, gave you everything you needed. Or Gingrich. Come on. I mean, it's a gift from heaven. Dark eyebrows, 5 o'clock shadow, jowls. Gingrich always looked as though he was eating some small animal, you know, and it was stuffed in his mouth. He was still getting it down. But what if Gingrich looked like John Edwards, for example? Then what do you do? Well, you work on it. You find it. It's there. You just have to look, because it's not what God gives you. It's what you find.
What if the obverse is true? What if someone has bizarre features and the person is kind of decent? Assume a benign Ross Perot, if you will.
Well, I mean, I'm a lefty. Look at Kerry. Kerry has got magnificent features, and the right wing caricaturists, and there are not very many good ones, I have to say, except for Ramirez in L.A. The right wing caricaturists will be vicious with him, but those of us who are everywhere else on the spectrum will find great fun with Kerry, but we'll use the features to say other things, you know, to whatever extent he's turning a blind eye toward certain issues. We can show those elephant eyes of his that are kind of like half closed and world weary and making subtle choices, and that tiny, tiny mouth that's just kind of like stuck under the nose and in the shadow of it almost disappearing. That mouth can be portrayed as something that doesn't quite do the job. It's not big enough to handle what needs to be said if the situation calls for it. If you're a caricaturist, you're in control. The subject isn't controlling you. You're controlling the subject. So you can make those features do what you want. But that would be the hallmark of a good caricaturist, as opposed to just an ordinary person who likes to draw, who thinks that caricature is about making small things smaller and big things bigger.
How do you define your style? Because it's outsized, you exaggerate the feature and blow the face up and distort it. How would you describe it?
I consider myself a traditional caricaturist. My great heroes are David Levine and Thomas Nast and Ralph Steadman. To me, it's all about content, and the older I've gotten, I think you see this in the book, the more conservative I've gotten about what to exaggerate and how to, because I think that looking deeply into a face will yield you more The younger I am in the book, you see the more outlandish the caricature, the more stretched out and bizarre. And I think it's just a nature of the maturing process where you can see you take greater joy in more subtle things.
Are there other ways that your style has changed?
Well, I think so. I mean, I don't. Through the book, you see there's pen and ink, and then I go to acrylic paint and oil paint. I run the gamut. There's charcoal drawings in there. There's watercolor. There's a flirtation for a couple of years with computer art, where I would take a piece of clay and mold a face out of clay, then shoot it with 35mm camera because we didn't have digital cameras yet. Then I'd run to the drugstore, get the thing developed, and then scan that into the computer and then festoon that clay image with drawings and paintings and photographs and do a kind of a montage. After a while, I got the idea that it was so much nicer to just take out a piece of paper and draw again. So I gave up on that. But I think it's always important to keep experimenting, keep trying new things. And, you know, at the end of the book, you see where I'm actually now starting to make independent films using still images.
What's the film? What are some of the films on?
I've made two short films so far, each 7 minutes long. One on a Mexican immigrant who was trying to eke out a living in Farmingville, Long Island, a very hostile place for immigrants. And then while I was editing that one, 9/11 happened, and I live in New York, so everybody with a camera went out after 9/11 and just shot pictures of Manhattan, and I cut my pictures into a 7-minute film.
What was it like for you that day?
on September 11th? It was an ordinary day with the TV on, and there I saw the things start to happen, and I called my wife from my studio, and the phones were dead. And that told me I better just get over there and gather my wife up and try to find my daughter. And we walked down about 100 blocks to her school.
She was 12 at the time?
Yeah, right. And the subways were not running.
Was she at the school when you got there?
No, she wasn't there. Someone else had picked her up. But since the phones were dead, we didn't know who had picked her up. And the schools didn't keep records because they were in chaos. It was an awful day.
How long did it take you to find her?
Our guess turned out right. We decided we knew who had picked her up and where they were, and we were right. So we got home. The buses we found were running, and we got a bus back, and there she was, safe and sound. It was no problem. But that was a strange day because it was the worst day in the history, I guess, of New York, aside from the draft riots. And here we had people calmly walking home. No police. No authority figure. People were leaving their jobs and in a kind of a solemn parade were just walking home through the streets of New York. It was a day where of unspeakable horror, but it was also a day where I was very proud of us. I was proud of New York. I was proud of the United States. 9/11 has been perverted by this presidential campaign into something it isn't. It's something that has tremendous meaning for people, especially people in New York and in Washington. And it has nothing to do with our joining an international jihad.
Well, I'm speaking with Steve Brodner, who is the author of Freedom Fries, which is a collection of his political art, his caricatures, mostly, over the last 25 years. Tell me about your impressions of W. You followed him at his governor's race.
Right.
So you knew him before a lot of us did. And what features did you pick up on and draw and address?
A lot of people are saying that he was a different man when he was governor of Texas. When I went down there, Esquire sent me to do a story on him, art journalism, where I draw and I interview at the same time. I met Joe O'Neill, who he mentioned last night as having introduced him to his wife. I met Karl Rove without knowing who he would become. I spent an hour with Carl while he explained to me the rationale behind the McKinley election and how he related that to W.
Did he seem like a megalomaniac at that point?
He seemed like the most gentle, unassuming fellow. Everybody, you know, when you're having a one-on-one conversation with somebody, you see the real person. And if it's long enough, they'll let down their guard and you see the decency in them. The difference is when you go back to your studio and you do a political cartoon about them, you don't draw the real person. You're drawing the mask. You're drawing the flag that they represent. So a political cartoon of Bush that I do would not represent the impressions that I had of him as a person doing a one-on-one interview with him, which I did. I found it to be very affable, very likable, almost lovable figure. Intellectual gravitas is not called for in that job. The governor is not the most powerful man in Texas. The speaker is, lieutenant governor is, who at that time was Bob Bullock, who was a Democrat. And Bush got on with him famously. He had to because it was a Democrat legislature. So that Bush, the conciliatory, compassionate conservative, he really needed to understand what those words meant in Texas to
get
on.
Were you surprised by this transformation then?
Everybody was. People in Texas were, to see him become this radical. But that's what he is. He is a radical Republican, hard right, the most hard right president I think we've ever had in this country, at least in modern times.
So how do you draw him then? What do you look at to exaggerate or point out?
Well, he helps a lot. His face, you know, God gives you lots with Bush. The eyes are extremely close together. Everything looks pinched. The nose looks like it's been pinched. The eyes look like they're pinched together. And to me, that symbolizes a person who's looking at himself all the time, just inward, constricted, not aware of the outward, the environment around him, what the world thinks, what he's doing to the physical environment, unaware, just inward, insular, onanistic.
You don't draw that, though.
No, I don't. But he's a very, extremely limited person. We're seeing that in the debates now. It's shocking, I think, to people who've wanted to believe the hype and the generated image about Bush to see him out there naked and exposed as what he is, which is really an extremely limited person who can be promoted into a position of being salesman for extremely hard right policies, neocon policies, and that's why it seems to me to be falling apart.
I mean, they made this front man a giant, and then we look at him and he's not a giant.
That's right. That's right.
And I think they did the reverse with Kerry. They made him out to be this wishy-washy, indecisive, almost cowardly person, and then America sees him on the stage. Well, one, he's incredibly smart and well-versed and articulate, seems strong, looks the part, and boom, their PR campaign is burst.
Right. It's one guy now looks like Lincoln, and the other guy looks like Howdy Doody. It had nothing to do with hype. This was just happened to be this debate business turned out to be a vestige of the past, pre-hype, and it comes back to bite them. But so Bush is easy to render that way as a kind of very limited, hollow, puppet-like stooge for the policies of the people who are really running the government, Dick Cheney, Karl Rove, Rumsfeld, etc.
And Rumsfeld you have as a caveman in one of these drawings.
Yeah, I have the Trojan horse with the face of Jefferson, because the claim is that we're bringing democracy, as Bush says, spread freedom to Iraq. And so Cheney and Rumsfeld and others are deplaning the Trojan horse just as cavemen with clubs and torches.
And you also have Ashcroft, one of my favorite drawings in this whole thing, is Ashcroft as a hitman with a gun in his hand, blowing the gun after he shot holes through the Declaration of Independence. Where did that run?
That was a cover for The Nation, and that combines his his love of guns and his disdain for the Constitution. It's sort of an easy hit.
You write in the introduction to this book, Steve Brodner, the book's Freedom Fries, that this is the most important time for making satiric art in my memory. What do you mean by that? Why is that?
The stakes are highest. I don't think even during Vietnam that we have been at such a decisive moment. I really see this as a choice for America, a choice between a future dominated by religious mythology, fundamentalism in this country, suppression of dissent, mockery of thought and reason, versus an ability to discuss, an ability to have conversations, tolerance, thinking, learning. To me, it's almost like one side represents the Reformation and the other one the Enlightenment.
There is something profoundly anti-intellectual and irrational about the appeals from the right and from the Republican Party right now. Are you, as an artist, are you as an illustrator who has to deal with editors and publishers, free to express yourself on the issues of these days?
On occasion. The book represents, the book has 360 some odd pieces in it. So it's easy to get the impression from the book that, oh yeah, that's what he does. One after another, he just pops off these strong, angry, pissed off political diatribes. But that's not the case at all. It's very cherry picked, selectively chosen from thousands of pieces, most of which are highly compromised.
What way? How?
Results of negotiation with a publication. There's just so far you can push The New Yorker, for example. Each magazine has its own style and its own willingness to degree of willingness to say things.
And some of these pieces have unpublished under them, including some incredible ones of Rush Limbaugh as an anus, for instance,
right.
Or the Pope as someone who's rubbing his hands together after botched abortions.
Right, a back alley abortionist. Those pieces were deemed unsuitable for publication. There's one since the book that's not been published in mainstream press after being shown to everyone and actually praised by everyone, which is should Bush as Mickey Mouse in Fantasia as the Sorcerer's Apprentice, where he's smashing the broom, which is Saddam, the offending broom, and then the shards of wood are all flying into the air and falling to earth as hundreds of little Osama bin Ladens carrying buckets of bombs. I think to me, that the Fantasia metaphor is a very strong explanation of how I feel about the war. But magazines won't want to touch it because I think they're afraid of Disney litigating, and they're famously litigious. I think that you take it as far as you can. Sometimes you go over the line, knowing that in the course of your career, things are going to get through. There's not a lot of money in that. I mean, getting things killed, but you do your best and you try really hard.
Well, let's leave it at that. I highly, very highly recommend your book, Steve Brodner. The book again is called Freedom Fries: The Political Art of Steve Brodner. Thanks for being my guest.
Thank you, Matt.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.